Chapter 49. I never saw such character portrayed in a picture face before. De Melville. There is a benignant simplicity about the execution of this work which warms the heart toward it as much, full as much, as it fascinates the eye. Landseer. One cannot see it without longing to contemplate the artist. Frederick William. Send me the entire edition, together with the plate, and the original portrait, and name your own price. And would you like to come over, and stay a while with Napoleon at Wilhelmskolno? It shall not cost you a cent. William III. Does the race of man love a lord? Often a quite assified remark becomes sanctified by use and petrified by custom. It is then a permanency, its term of activity a geologic period. The day after the arrival of Prince Henry I met an English friend, and he rubbed his hands, and broke out with a remark that was charged to the brim with joy, that was evidently a pleasant salve to an old sore place. Many a time I've had to listen without retort to an old saying that is irritatingly true, and until now seemed to offer no chance for a return jibe. An Englishman does dearly love a lord. But after this, I shall talk back, and say, how about the Americans? Apostrophe, it is a curious thing, the currency that an idiotic saying can get. The man that first says it thinks he has made a discovery. The man he says it to, thinks the same. It departs on its travels, is received everywhere with admiring acceptance, and not only as a piece of rare and acute observation, but as being exhaustively true and profoundly wise, and so it presently takes its place in the world's list of recognized and established wisdoms, and after that no one thinks of examining it to see whether it is really entitled to its high honors or not. I call to mind instances of this in two well-established proverbs, whose dullness is not surpassed by the one about the Englishman, and his love for a lord. One of them records the American's adoration of the almighty dollar, the other the American millionaire girl's ambition, to trade cash for a title, with a husband thrown in. It isn't merely the American that adores the almighty dollar, it is the human race. The human race has always adored the hatful of shells, or the bale of calico, or the half bushel of brass rings, or the handful of steel fish hooks, or the houseful of black wives, or the zareba full of cattle, or the 20 camels and asses, or the factory, or the farm, or the block of buildings, or the railroad bonds, or the bank stock, or the hoarded cash, or anything that stands for wealth and consideration and independence, and can secure to the possessor, that most precious of all things, another man's envy. It was a dull person that invented the idea that the American's devotion to the dollar is more strenuous than another's. Rich American girls do buy titles, but they did not invent that idea. It had been worn threadbare several hundred centuries before America was discovered. European girls still exploit it as briskly as ever, and when a title is not to be had for the money in hand, they buy the husband without it. They must put up the ot, or there is no trade. The commercialization of brides is substantially universal, except in America. It exists with us, to some little extent, but in no degree approaching a custom. The Englishman dearly loves a lord. What is the soul and source of this love? I think the thing could be more correctly worded. The human race dearly envies a lord. That is to say, it envies the lord's place. Why? On two accounts, I think. Its power and its conspicuousness. Where conspicuousness carries with it a power which, by the light of our own observation and experience, we are able to measure and comprehend, I think our envy of the possessor is as deep and as passionate as is that of any other nation. No one can care less for a lord than the backwoodsman, who has had no personal contact with lords, and has seldom heard them spoken of. But I will not allow that any Englishman has a profounder envy of a lord than has the average American who has lived long years in a European capital and fully learned how immense is the position the lord occupies. of any 10,000 Americans who eagerly gather, at vast inconvenience, to get a glimpse of Prince Henry, all but a couple of hundred will be there out of an immense curiosity. They are burning up with desire to see a personage who is so much talked about. They envy him, but it is conspicuousness they envy mainly, not the power that is lodged in his royal quality and position, for they have but a vague and spectral knowledge and appreciation of that, though their environment and associations they have been accustomed to regard such things lightly and as not being very real. Consequently, they are not able to value them enough to consumingly envy them. But, whenever an American or other human being is in the presence, for the first time, of a combination of great power and conspicuousness which he thoroughly understands and appreciates, his eager curiosity and pleasure will be well sodden with that other passion, envy, whether he suspects it or not. At any time, on any day, in any part of America, you can confer a happiness upon any passing stranger by calling his attention to any other passing stranger and saying, "Do you see that gentleman going along there? It is Mr. Rockefeller. Watch his eye." It is a combination of power and conspicuousness which the man understands. When we understand rank, we always like to rub against it. When a man is conspicuous, we always want to see him. Also, if he will pay us an attention, we will manage to remember it. Also, we will mention it now and then, casually, sometimes to a friend, or if a friend is not handy, we will make out with a stranger. Well, then, what is rank, and what is conspicuousness? At once we think of kings and aristocracies, and of worldwide celebrities and soldierships, the arts, letters, etc., and we stop there. But that is a mistake. Rank holds its court and receives its homage on every round of the ladder, from the emperor down to the rat catcher. And distinction, also, exists on every round of the ladder, and commands its due of deference and envy. To worship rank and distinction is the dear and valued privilege of all the human race, and it is freely and joyfully exercised in democracies as well as in monarchies and even, to some extent, among those creatures whom we impertinently call the lower animals. For even they have some poor little vanities and foibles, though in this matter they are paupers as compared to us. A Chinese emperor has the worship of his 400 millions of subjects, but the rest of the world is indifferent to him. A Christian emperor has the worship of his subjects, and of a large part of the Christian world outside of his domains, but he is a matter of indifference to all China. A king, class A, has an extensive worship. A king, class B, has a less extensive worship. Class C, class D, class E get a steadily diminishing share of worship. Class 50, Sultan of Zanzibar, class P, Sultan of Sulu, and class W, half King of Samoa, get no worship at all outside their own little patch of sovereignty. Take the distinguished people along down. Each has his group of homage payers. In the Navy, there are many groups. They start with the secretary and the admiral, and go down to the quartermaster and below, for there will be groups among the sailors, and each of these groups will have a tar who is distinguished for his battles, or his strength, or his daring, or his profanity, and is admired and envied by his group. The same with the army, the same with the literary and journalistic craft, the publishing craft, the cod fishery craft, Standard Oil, U.S. Steel, the Class A Hotel and the rest of the alphabet in that line, the Class A Prize Fighter and the rest of the alphabet in his line, clear down to the lowest and obscurest six-boy gang of little gamins, with its one boy that can thrash the rest, and to whom he is King of Samoa, bottom of the royal race, but looked up to with a most ardent admiration and envy. There is something pathetic, and funny, and pretty, about this human race's fondness for contact with power and distinction, and for the reflected glory it gets out of it. The king, Class A, is happy in the state banquet and the military show which the emperor provides for him, and he goes home and gathers the queen and the princelings around him in the privacy of the spare room, and tells them all about it, and says, "His Imperial Majesty put his hand upon my shoulder in the most friendly way, just as friendly and familiar, oh, you can't imagine it. And everybody seeing him do it, charming, perfectly charming." The King, Class G, is happy in the cold collation, and the police parade provided for him by the King, Class B, and goes home, and tells the family all about it, and says, "And His Majesty took me into his own private cabinet for a smoke and a chat, and there we sat just as sociable, and talking away, and laughing and chatting, just the same, as if we had been born in the same bunk, and all the servants in the anteroom could see us doing it. Oh, it was too lovely for anything." The King, Class Q, is happy in the modest entertainment furnished him by the King, Class M, and goes home, and tells the household about it, and is as grateful and joyful over it as were his predecessors in the gaudier attentions that had fallen to their larger lot. Emperors, kings, artisans, peasants, big people, little people, at the bottom we are all alike, and all the same, all just alike on the inside, and when our clothes are off, nobody can tell which of us is which. We are unanimous in the pride we take in good and genuine compliments paid us, and distinctions conferred upon us, in attentions shown. There is not one of us, from the emperor down, but is made like that. Do I mean attentions shown us by the guest? No, I mean simply flattering attentions, let them come whence they may. We despise no source that can pay us a pleasing attention. There is no source that is humble enough for that. You have heard a dear little girl say to a frozy and disreputable dog, "He came right to me, and let me pat him on the head, and he wouldn't let the others touch him," and you have seen her eyes dance with pride in that high distinction. You have often seen that. If the child were a princess, would that random dog be able to confer the like glory upon her with his pretty compliment? Yes, and even in her mature life and seated upon a throne, she would still remember it, still recall it, still speak of it with frank satisfaction. That charming and lovable German princess and poet, Carmen Silva, Queen of Romania, remembers yet that the flowers of the woods and fields talked to her when she was a girl, and she sets it down in her latest book, and that the squirrels conferred upon her and her father the valued compliment of not being afraid of them, and see one of them, holding a nut between its sharp little teeth, ran right up against my father. It has the very note of, "He came right to me, and let me pat him on the head," and he, when it saw itself reflected in his boot, it was very much surprised, and stopped for a long time to contemplate itself in the polished leather. Then it went its way. And the birds, she still remembers with pride, that they came boldly into my room, when as he had neglected her duty, and put no food on the window sill for them. She knew all the wild birds, and forgets the royal crown on her head to remember with pride, that they knew her, also that the wasp and the bee were personal friends of hers, and never forgot that gracious relationship to her injury. Ever have I been stung by a wasp or a bee. And here is that proud note again that sings in that little child's elation in being singled out, among all the company of children, for the random dog's honor conferring attentions. Then in the very worst summer for wasps, when, in lunching out of doors, our table was covered with them, and everyone else was stung, they never hurt me. When a queen whose qualities of mind and heart and character are able to add distinction to so distinguished a place as a throne, remembers with grateful exultation, after 30 years, honors, and distinctions conferred upon her by the humble wild creatures of the forest, we are helped to realize that complimentary attentions, homage, distinctions, are of no caste, but are above all caste, that they are a nobility conferring power apart. We all like these things. When the gate guard at the railway station passes me through unchallenged, and examines other people's tickets, I feel as the king, class A, felt when the emperor put the imperial hand on his shoulder, everybody seeing him do it. And as the child felt when the random dog allowed her to pat his head and ostracized the others. And as the princess felt when the wasp spared her and stung the rest. And I felt just so 4 years ago in Vienna and remember it yet when the helmeted police shut me off with 50 others from a street which the emperor was to pass through. And the captain of the squad turned and saw the situation and said indignantly to that guard, "Can't you see it is the hair mark, Twain? Let him through. It was 4 years ago, but it will be 400 before I forget the wind of self-complacency that rose in me and strained my buttons when I marked the deference for me evoked in the faces of my fellow rabble and noted, mingled with it, a puzzled and resentful expression which said, as plainly as speech could have worded it, and who in the nation is the hair mark, Twain Umgateswilen? How many times in your life have you heard this boastful remark? I stood as close to him as I am to you. I could have put out my hand and touched him. We have all heard it many and many a time. It was a proud distinction to be able to say those words. It brought envy to the speaker, a kind of glory, and he basked in it and was happy through all his veins. And who was it he stood so close to? The answer would cover all the greats. Sometimes it was a king, sometimes it was a renowned highwayman, sometimes it was an unknown man killed in an extraordinary way, and made suddenly famous by it. Always it was a person who was for the moment the subject of public interest of a village. I was there, and I saw it myself. That is a common, and envy-compelling remark. It can refer to a battle, to a handing, to a coronation, to the killing of Jumbo by the railway train, to the arrival of Jenny Lind at the battery, to the meeting of the President and Prince Henry, to the chase of a murderous maniac, to the disaster in the tunnel, to the explosion in the subway, to a remarkable dogfight, to a village church struck by lightning. It will be said, more or less causally, by everybody in America who has seen Prince Henry do anything, or try to. The man who was absent, and didn't see him do anything, will scoff. It is his privilege, and he can make capital out of it too. He will seem, even to himself, to be different from other Americans, and better. As his opinion of his superior Americanism grows, and swells, and concentrates and coagulates, he will go further and try to belittle the distinction of those that saw the prince do things, and will spoil their pleasure. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.